You're listening to Better Fishing with Two Bald Biologists, sponsored by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. I'm Corey Oakley, the Assistant Chief of Fisheries Management for the Inland Fisheries Division.
And I'm Ben Ricks, Coastal Region Fisheries Supervisor.
We are fisheries biologists who are avid anglers. We want to link the work we do as biologists to your fishing. Our goal in this podcast is to use the information we have as an agency to help you catch more fish and learn about our state's great aquatic natural resources. All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of Better Fishing with Two Bald Biologists. I'm Corey, and there's Ben.
Hey, guys.
Today, we're talking about cold water cats, and we had a great day fishing for cold water cats with our guest today, Tyler Barnes. Tyler, how are you doing today?
Man, it's fantastic, man. What a great day to be here.
Yeah.
The man's on a three-peat.
He is on a three-peat. Tyler's been with us before, and he's back again, and we had a great day fishing, and we'll talk a lot about that today. But Tyler, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, man. So like I said, it's such a great opportunity to be here with you guys today. And you said third show. Yeah. So we're out here. We're doing our thing. And so my name's Tyler Barnes. I have always targeted catfish even since I was a little boy, which led into tournament fishing, which also led into being blessed with the North Carolina state record for flathead catfish. And a little bit about me is my goal is to get a lot more people involved in the sport of catfishing and make it just more known out there because it's such a good sport and it's an awesome opportunity for a lot of anglers to get out on the water to target these awesome fish. So, you know, I'm just having a lot of fun promoting the sport of catfishing.
If you didn't hear the first podcast, we don't need to tell the whole story all over again. But
go back and listen to the first podcast.
Go back and listen. Yeah. I've been woken up now twice at like 3 a.m. to certify a state record catfish.
These guys need to fish in the daytime. And but anyway.
Yes.
That might be the first thing we would suggest to them is start fishing in the daytime. I mean,
that was one of the best things about this trip.
We fished in the daytime.
It was during the day. You know, it is possible. So go back, listen to the tale of the state record story and how I lost a lot of sleep to help Tyler out. I'd do it again in a heartbeat. But yeah, let's catch them during the daytime.
There's a couple of things that have changed from the time that we recorded that podcast to now, which is about a year and a half now?
Right.
Probably a year and a half. Last time we recorded the first catfish, Trophy Catfish podcast. One, Tyler now has his own business for catfishing. He's got Four Reel. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, so last April, 2023, April 1st, we started a fishing apparel brand called Four Reel Fishing, and it actually originated from social media on TikTok. So if you follow me on TikTok, you'll see that we do a lot of pretty much everything and anything catfishing, to tying rigs, to fishing, to specifically doing live fishing shows. So what I like to do is take people out, and while I'm on the boat fishing, I'm fishing actually live so people can come out and enjoy and see what it's all about. But yeah, the brand started from the followers, actually. So they noticed one thing that I did repetitively was I was always saying, for real. I was like, for real. They were like, man,
that's
Tyler,
true. He does say that.
For real.
Yeah. It's like me with absolutely. I say absolutely. Like my son's like, man, you on the podcast, all you say is absolutely. You got to stop doing it. Absolutely, I do. For real.
So it kind of took off from there, you know. So it's always been For Real Fishing, and we got us a little website up, and we're promoting, and it's really a community brand. I just love to see the family and the community that we have with For Real Fishing growing very rapidly, and it's fun, and, you know, primarily it's to just to get out here and spread awareness of the sport of fishing.
Yeah, that's the one thing I will say about Tyler. I follow him on Facebook. I'm not on TikTok, but it comes over on Facebook a lot. And the man fishes a lot. And he records it a lot. So if you want to know anything about catfishing, you want to just watch somebody catfish, which, I mean, if that's what you want to do, it's great.
Because
Tyler's out there doing it. So the opportunity to see what you're doing, to see the different techniques that you use and that kind of stuff. And you explain it really well and you go through everything. So I really see that in you. You trying to, I guess, spread the gospel of catfishing worldwide.
That's it, man.
You're trying to do.
That is it.
You're doing a pretty good job of it. So, you know, times are changing for sure.
I definitely appreciate it. And we're working hard at what we do. And even if you don't like to specifically catfish, I do encourage you to come over and hang out and and get to know everybody in the chat room and stuff and just come hang out and have a good time.
Well, I mean, we've said this multiple times on the podcast. Like, if you're listening and you're like, oh, another catfish podcast, I have learned things from Tyler. I do not catfish all the time.
Yeah.
I have learned things from Tyler that I have put to use in what I do.
Yes, yes.
And the other day, I was showing my new rigs that I tie that are not the same, but I took what I needed from Tyler and made it my own. And one of my buddies who's done it his whole life was like, man, that's pretty smart. I'm like, well, I stole it from Tyler.
Stole it. So at least you admitted it, that you stole it. At least you didn't say, you know, I'm a genius. I came up with this myself. At least yeah. You admitted you stole it from someone else.
Right. We're born originals and we die copies by the time it's all said and done.
Yeah, that's so true.
At the end of the day, there's always some tidbit from some other place that yeah. You can apply to your own fishing. And sometimes it comes up in the least likely places that you think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Trout fishing helps with bluegill fishing. Muskie fishing helps with bass fishing. It's amazing how it starts to translate really quick.
And we say this a lot on the podcast. There's only but so many ways to go after a predator. And it kind of translates, even though there's little wrinkles and little differences, and we'll talk about that today on the podcast. There was differences between this fishing trip than the previous fishing trip. So it was a little bit different style. We did a couple of different things that we didn't do on the original podcast with you when we were on the noose. And so I think every time you go and you go with somebody different, you learn something every time, and it will translate to what you're doing on the water for sure.
And the main thing is we are a long, long way from livers on the bank.
Oh, my goodness, are we?
Like, yeah. We got a whole different setup, a whole different...
My granddad would be lost.
If you're thinking, man, I just don't want... Like, that's not for me because I don't really like chicken... Which I will say, I'm not a big fan of using chicken livers for bait as a general rule.
They don't stay on the hook to start with. I mean, my granddaddy, he was like, you know, getting the chicken livers out, and then he'd get pantyhose out, put around the chicken livers to keep them on the hook. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on. I was like, why do we bring pantyhose fishing?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I was always using, because I didn't want to mess with them in my childhood when I was trying to catch catfish on occasion. We would just catch a brim and chop it up, and lo and behold, you know, Tyler, that's a good segue. Why don't you tell us what we did today or what we did last Monday?
So, as far as the bait standpoint, what we primarily focused on as far as bait was, of course, gizzard shad and white perch. And as far as the first fishing trip goes, it was two totally separate trips to start with. So we were in the summer. Our last trip, we were primarily targeting flathead catfish. And the second trip, we ventured out to the Cape Fear River and started targeting some blue catfish. And as I think we all were able to see, it was totally different tactics. I mean, same gear, essentially, same rod, same line, same, pretty much the same stuff, same setups, but different approaches.
Not quite the same. You've gone from lime green to bright chartreuse yellow rods.
All of his rods matched.
All of his rods matched. I asked him where his yellow stickers were and the yellow stuff in the boat, but he did have yellow, bright, bright yellow rods, so that if we were fishing at night, we could have used a black light and seen our rods. You know, that would have been important.
Yeah. We talked about this in every catfish podcast.
It's ridiculous.
Cat fishermen have become the most stylish guys out on the water.
Yeah. They look like they're going to a concert instead of going fishing. I mean, it's just crazy how everything matches. Everything's beautiful. Everything's in place. It's quite stylish. I have an appreciation for it. I mean, I'm not going to do it, but I have an appreciation for it.
Well, and I can appreciate it because if you have all the same stuff, then you know how those rods are going to behave.
That's right,
Tyler?
That's correct. That's right. Everything matches. There wasn't a thing on the boat that wasn't in sync, was it? It was all the same.
That's
every
right.
Day was the same. But, you know, that's me too, though. You know, I mean, I'm one of those guys that if I know it works and I'm fishing with 8 or 10 or 12 rods and they're all identical and they're the same stuff, then my confidence is much more. So I like everything to match. I don't like this rod to have this line and this one to have this line and this. They all are the same.
Well, the age-old theory that the biggest fish hits the lightest rod.
Correct.
You fix that when you have all the same rods.
It ain't. Yeah. He's done no matter what.
He's toast.
I got him. I figured him out.
So for those that didn't listen to the previous podcast, explain your rod, your setup, all that jazz so that people, if they want to go try this, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, certainly. So, and like I say, it all depends on what the angler's targeting, what their purpose is. Are they going on the weekend? Are they, you know, into it hardcore and want to go every weekend? Are they tournament anglers and so on? So, but what I prefer, I go every weekend. I target these fish on a, try to be a weekly basis. And I also, like I said, I also do a lot of tournament catfishing. So what I've learned over the years, and I've used a slew of rods, I've used a slew of, you know, line and hooks and everything. But what I've found to work best for me right now is, as far as the reel goes, I'm using a pin fathom 20 level line. And on that pin fathom, I'm using a 150-pound braided line.
Bluefin tuna fishing, folks.
Bluefin tuna fishing.
Bluefin tunas.
And a lot of times, and probably whoever's listening to this thing is like, Tyler, you're using 150? Well, yeah, I'm using 150. And, you know, the reason for that is, as you know, braided line is got a thin diameter. So there's really not a big difference between, you know, 80, 100-pound line and 150. So for me being a tournament angler and me being a guy that does not like to have the, oh, he broke my line story, I can assure you, if you spool up with a 150-pound braided line, well, just that's going to lead to a couple of things. That's going to lead to you being able to pull that fish out of heavy cover with a lot more confidence. It's certainly not really going to cast any different. But it might hold a little bit less line, but when you're catfishing, as far as anchor fishing goes, you don't really need to have 500 yards of line. You're essentially tossing it behind the boat. But, you know, it just gives me a big confidence booster out on the water, knowing that whatever fish hits of any size, I'm going to not have any issue. But as far as the rods go, I firmly believe in using the Hellcat rods by Catch the Fever.
And all of one color.
All of them are yellow.
They come in other colors, but his are all yellow. I mean, you can get them in orange, you can get them in green. There's probably a blue.
There he is. There's a blue. There's actually a white if you don't like the flashy color. Yeah.
But what I've noticed from catfishermen.
But you can't have white and a green and a yellow and a red. You got to have them all the same color.
In fact, if you were to buy your wife or a girlfriend one of the pink ones, I think that means you have to buy all new rods.
All new. Yeah. Everyone.
There would be no reason, you know. Plan goes right out.
We told you we were going to beat this chicken. So.
Well, I am thankful that the, you know, Catch the Fever does offer a lot of different varieties of catfish rods. They also have the Big Cat Fever rod series, which is a traditional white rod, and they also got it in a black and red. So, yeah, I mean, you've got all kinds of variances, whatever you prefer. But like I said, at the moment, I'm using the yellow heavy action Hellcat rods. And as far as the leader line goes, I'm using 100 pound.
It was yellow too.
Yeah, it was yellow.
Not his leader line. His braid was yellow.
His braid was yellow.
It's got to look good.
I was going to say the leader wasn't yellow.
See, look, the thing with the matching is you can go out and whether you know what you're doing or not, you at least look good. Okay. That's really all that matters.
It's a stylish sport.
It is so stylish, but it's a very fun sport too, right? So we had a blast out there at, but yeah, the leader line is 100-pound heavy cover leader line. That's also a Catch the Fever product. And as far as the rigs, it is what we were using on the day that we went was your traditional sinker slider rig. Okay, so on your main line, you've got a sinker slider. We were throwing 10 ounces of lead attached to a pre-made leader, which was roughly 18, 20 inches long or so, with a stainless steel barrel swivel, 18 inches a leader, a 3-inch yellow peg float.
See, that's my theory, is he bought some corks to put on his leader line, and they were yellow, and he was like,
I gotta buy all new rods.
Gotta get all new rods now.
If they quit making yellow corks,
I bought a 10-cent float, and I gotta go buy $100+ rod.
See, you're getting it. You're understanding. Y'all doing good.
Yeah.
Oh, we have the same disease in a different way, but certainly. We understand.
Certainly. And as far as the hooks go, I'm a huge fan of either the 9-0 Charlie Brown circle hooks or the 10-0 Daiichi offset circle hooks, and make sure that those hooks are snailed on. That's a huge factor with hookup ratio, especially when using circle.
Well, there you have it. Bluefin tuna fishing at its finest right there.
It's correct. Heavy gear. It's big fish. There's a lot of wood in the river. A
lot of debris.
And also, when you got a 8 to 10 ounce weight, there's really not much casting wise that you can't handle. In fact,
that's right.
Probably a little bit larger diameter helps with the backlash a little bit as well.
I don't really ever have any problems with backlash pretty much at all.
He excels at casting, is what I just heard.
Yeah, pretty much the best.
So no. I'll say that I'm always impressed when I watch you cast. I'm like, I can't do that. I stink at that maneuver.
The one thing that we did this time that we didn't do last time were the floats. And that was in part, if my understanding is correct, Tyler, tell me if I'm wrong, but you, because we were using cut bait, we were trying to get our baits off the bottom just slightly, since the fish wasn't swimming around like it naturally would be. That cut bait with that float just kind of keeps it from just sitting smack dab on the bottom, right?
Yeah, certainly. And with the blue catfish anyway, they tend to be suspended a little bit. The flathead catfish, they spend their life on the bottom. Okay, so they're always on the bottom. They're hanging out on the bottom. Essentially, is why whenever I'm using live bait or targeting flatheads specifically, I never throw a cork. I want it on the bottom too, right in front of them. With the blue catfish, I do think that the peg float helps give it just a little bit of lift in the water to suspend a bait just a little bit, which I think can help entice the fish to make a reaction or find the bait a little bit easier.
So the other thing that we did, that was, we did it, you know, last time as well, and it's really impressive. You know, we're fishing a river that's, how wide were we fishing?
150 feet.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
In certain spots more, yeah. In certain spots less. But yeah, on average, I'd say that's about right. But the way we placed our baits.
Oh, yeah.
Very methodical, you know, and very much a method to it. Like, we weren't just slinging.
No.
Like, we were slinging for two reasons. One, to cover the spot, but also to avoid tangles. Right, Tyler?
That's correct.
So walk us through kind of your mindset as you're putting 8 to 10 rods out. Like, how are you trying to spread them out for fishing efficiency and also for no tangling? Because, I mean, really, when you're starting to fish a lot of rods, not tangling is a huge objective in its own
especially
right.
Especially with catfish. Right. I mean, well, with any fish, but catfish in particular can make a mess.
Yeah, certainly. So, like, as far as it goes, as far as, like, staggering baits out or how do I go about it, is there a certain way? As far as the boat setup goes, let's start there. That's going to depend on the water level. How fast is the water moving? Am I able to keep 10 ounces of lead from getting pushed behind the boat? That's the first factor. So, but when we went, there was a pretty good amount of current. So as throughout the day, we kind of focused more on one side of the river or the other. We never really anchored out in the middle. And that is to also help keep these lines and stuff from getting tangled up. But typically what I do is whenever I pick an area to fish, I always start from left to right. And I will typically kind of stagger the baits a little bit. I'll throw one short, one far, one short, one far. And then maybe when I get to the back of the boat, I might do one kind of far, one further, one even further, and just keep them going down the line like that and kind of just stagger the baits out. And that's going to do a couple things. That's going to cover the hole that you're fishing, the area. And it's also going to help your, like I said, help your baits from not getting really tangled up. And that's another reason why I use those 10-ounce weights. Because if you're out there in the current that can push, you know, 3 ounces of lead to the back of the boat, well, all of your lines join, you know, together. And when that happens, guess what? Well, you've got 10 lines and a big knot, and then you're frustrated. So that's why I throw 10 ounces of lead no matter what. Because also, you know, when you stagger your baits out, like I talked, you know, just said about doing, you also reel them in perfectly straight because where your bait lands, it stays. So as you can imagine, fan casting out, when you reel in, as long as your lines stayed where you threw them, as long as you throw them, you know, spread out, you're going to reel in straight. So none of these lines, as y'all could tell throughout the day, we really didn't get any tangles. Even when we caught fish, I think we might have got, tangled a couple times, maybe fighting a fish.
Maybe once.
And we probably throwed out, oh my gosh, I don't know how many lines throughout the day, a lot. We throwed a bunch, But yeah, that's my tactic and that's my take on as far as, you know, throwing the baits out.
And we probably got tangled because you had some amateurs on the boat. But anyway, that's another story.
It's okay. No.
So you say 10 ounces no matter what. Well, it was funny because you said no matter what, which my question was if 10 ounces was what we do on the average, if it's heavy flow or high flows, what's the biggest you'll go?
16.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, so...
That's a pound.
That's a pound, folks. That's a pound weight.
If I have to go over 16 ounces, I won't fish there. But typically, under extreme situations where the river's really fast moving, got a lot of current, maybe it's a flood or something like that, essentially what I'll do is I'll maybe just go down to less rods at that point. I may only throw 6 or 8 instead of 12 and kind of, you know, hug the banks a little bit tighter. And even knowing that it's going to pull that 10 ounces of lead, at least I'll be not as big of a disaster, you know, throwing 12 rods. Because at some point, it doesn't really matter what amount of weight you throw, because when you throw, say, even a 16, you can throw a 16-ounce weight out, and with all the debris and the leaves and everything coming down the river catching your line, well, that 16 ounces just turned into 3 pounds, and it's just lifted, and, you know, it's inevitable. I mean, you can't. At some point, you just can't fight it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that is one of the things that I learned from Tyler that I put into my own technique, is I upped my weight, especially in situations where I was like, I want it to stay right there. And that's definitely something that I said, I watch these catfish boys do this. It ought to work for me too.
I'd never really thought about that until I went fishing with them the first time when we went down the noose. I was like, okay, so that weight is important, that he does not want that bait to move at all. And I never really had thought about it. I mean, I'd fished a noose a bunch and just the bait moved along with the current. But Tyler's very specific about the habitat he's targeting. He's not trying to, I mean, maybe you do sometimes, but every time we've been with you, you're very specific about, okay, I think I know that those fish should be here, here, and here along this bank. And that just comes with you having fished it so much. And that's the reason for those heavy weights, is I want it right there. I do not want it to move.
Tyler did not do this. Maybe I need to switch to 150-pound braid. Well, I can tell you that if you throw a heavier weight you get a little kink in your line, that weight will head over to Aunt Susie's place, if you know what I'm saying.
That thing's gone.
Yeah, you will hear a loud pop, and you will watch your rig disappear into the sunset somewhere along the horizon.
So, as long as there's not a boat over there that you're right. Putting a hole in, you're all right.
So, but yeah, I have learned that. So maybe that's another reason to use heavier line.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
I mean, we also had Carolina all out on the boat with
us. Yeah, so just to tell you a little bit about our day, we worked it out with Tyler and with the Carolina all out guys, with Chris and Josh. So this will be a TV show, probably sometime in the summer or early fall, where you'll get to see all of us on the boat and carrying on and catching fish and all that jazz. So that was a good day. I think the one thing that I'll remember about it is that there's 5 grown men in a pretty big skiff.
Giant boat.
Running roughly 50 to 55 miles an hour in about, in certain places, probably no more than 6 inches of water.
Hold on, man. We're going. And
Tyler's like, I don't know if we'll make it, but we're going to try. And I was like, this is interesting. This could end up bad.
Yo, just hold on. I got this.
But, you know, when you put a 300-horsepower motor behind an aluminum skiff, even though it's a large aluminum skiff, it's still an aluminum skiff. That thing will scoot for sure.
I've done some things in the state boat that are very akin to that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're going to get there,
but
you got to go.
The state was paying my boat maintenance bill.
Yeah, that's right.
Unlike Tyler, who's like, this is my recreational boat, and here we go.
Here we go.
So
we're going after it, man.
You know, I think that the thing I appreciated about it was a little bit different than the last time we went. Obviously, the weather's colder, for sure. You were thinking, you know, mainly we would catch some smaller blue cats, because you'd been earlier and the bite was a little off because the water was coming down. Lo and behold, we ran into quite a few flatheads.
Man, it was very interesting. It couldn't have been a better day, I don't think. I mean, it was fantastic. But
what I learned on that trip was that you were very specific about, and I know that comes with time and being on the water and knowing what to look for, but you were looking for very small pockets that would hold fish. You weren't like saying, well, they could be anywhere in the river, even though Ben and I would be like, they're everywhere.
But that's what our surveys would indicate.
Yeah, but for fishing purposes, you're very specific, and you would float over a spot and you'd see like 2 or 3 and you're like, all right, we're going to catch 2 or 3 here. And you'd set up this, you know, the elaborate thing that we just talked about, the 10 rods out across the water. and we catch like two, and you'd be like, all right, reel them in, we got to go.
That was it.
And I'm like, so we're done here? And so that's new to me. Like, for me, if I'm fishing and I catch two, I'm going to stay and see if I catch three. But your experience has told you there's two or three here. After that, it's time to go. We don't need to stay here. We're just going to waste time staying here longer, which I don't think most fishermen would do. Most anglers would not do that. Most anglers, if they caught two fish, they'd stay for another.
I thought a lot about that tactic, kind of had a lot of highway time here recently. And I thought a lot about that. And Tyler, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but the more I started thinking about it, the more I was like, well, we caught two fish, but those other six rods were still fishing.
And didn't catch
and they didn't get a bite.
That's right.
So, like, meanwhile, you're like, well, maybe we'll get another bite. Well, it's been 10 minutes with those other rods in the water and we didn't get a bite. So you were still fishing. I probably still would have given it a little bit longer. But at the same time, in some of my fishing, especially some of my bait fishing, it's like, we'll know within 20 minutes if they're here or not. And it's really no need to stay if they're not here.
I think that's a difference too, though, that you're natural bait fishing some way, whether it's with cut gizzard shad like we used this time or whether it was live bluegills the last time. I think you're right. I think if it's 10, 15, 20 minutes and you're not getting anything, particularly when the baits are staying in one spot, they're not moving, they're staying in one spot, it's time to probably move on.
I mean, the other strategy is to say, well, we're going to sit here until the fish move to us, you know, which can be effective. It just depends on what you're trying to do.
Well, what I'll say about this particular trip is that every spot we went to, we caught fish. Like, that's accolades to you for having that much experience that you knew the spots and you knew where to go. And we would catch either one to three, maybe four at a spot. I don't know that we caught four at a spot, but one to three. And then we move on and we just hit spots all day long and we caught fish at every spot that we went to. I don't think we missed a spot, maybe one that didn't have a fish, but it was pretty unusual.
Yeah, I think I pulled the anchor about 25 times. My arms were killing me at the end of the day.
You definitely earned your merit badge for anchor guy.
Yes.
For sure.
If anybody needs an anchor puller, apparently
you are the man.
I can pull an anchor.
Somehow I just found my way out of that. I don't know how that happened while I was on the boat. Had to eat something, had to take a drink, whatever it was. Had to talk on camera, whatever it might have been. It seemed like you always ended up with the anchor. Funny how that works.
So, this sport is amazing to me. And the fact that it's grown so much and the fact that we've gone from, instead of using egg sinkers, folks were using, you know, galvanized nuts and chicken livers to what we're at now, you know.
And that's all happened in my mind,
the last 20 years, probably even less than that.
It's like in the last decade or less that, and maybe in the last five, at least to me in North Carolina, maybe it's been happening in other parts of the country, but in North Carolina in the last five, it's really exploded. Like, and I think that part of that is the internet. I think it's social media and that thing, but it's amazing to me how many more people are doing it and how popular it's become. And just like now we have tournaments everywhere. We have tournaments occurring almost every weekend somewhere in North Carolina. And the pots are getting bigger and bigger and the payouts are bigger. And so it's on the rise for sure. It's probably our fastest growing group of anglers in North Carolina are probably cat fishermen. In fact, our surveys tell us, our angler surveys tell us that cat fishermen are the fastest growing group amongst our anglers.
Yeah, I mean, you can get boats now that are designed just for catfishing.
Man to our left has one.
He's got two of them.
Yeah, he has two of them. But he has a really fancy one now. Yeah,
that thing is
that thing's sweet.
Impressive.
Yeah, it's a nice boat.
We can't talk about catfish as fish biologists and not talk about the fact that while they are a great angling opportunity, they're not native to this area.
Yeah, that's right.
No, undeniable that they're fun to catch. I mean, I've had fun catching them.
We had a blast
a week ago. I've seen us both do it, and it worked out well for both of us in several different locations now. So not to take anything away from their angling opportunity, but they do cause some problems.
Yep, they do.
And are causing problems even now, especially in two different ways. Is, you know, the blue cats are, well, when they're small, they compete with your sunfish. When they're large, they compete with your predatory fish, but also they are tremendous prolific spawners. So yep. they also just in sheer biomass of fish that is allowed in a system, they are starting to absorb some of that and take away from some of our other fish populations, which is problematic.
Yeah, they're almost the perfect invader. They're omnivores, which means they'll eat anything. I mean, we've seen them eat dead things, you know, while fishing.
They will
live
eat
things.
A half a gizzard shad in a heartbeat.
They'll eat a half a gizzard shad in a heartbeat. Saw that. They'll eat a live bluegill in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
They love mussels and clams. You catch them in a lot of places and you pick them up and they'll jingle when you shake them because they got so many clams in their stomach.
The Roanoke surveys. I was on a Roanoke surveys this summer. And those blue cats, they're like a coin pouch. You know, yeah. they got so many muscles in their stomach that they feel like they've been eating rocks.
And they can compete at all sizes, whether they're little itty bitty things to really large. You know, now our state record's over 127 pounds out of the Roanoke. You know, the blue cat is just probably one of the perfect invaders to our system. And so you're right. It's all about biomass. They can just, there's just so many of them now that they've pushed a lot of things out that were once there.
Right. And flatheads are probably one of the most efficient big river predators as far as how they're designed.
They're super cool fish. They really are.
They have a big mouth that takes one, they're suction feeders, which means when they flare their gills,
it's over.
It creates a vacuum, you know.
If you swim by and he opens his mouth, it's over. It's you can't do anything about it.
It's like flushing the toilet, you know, and a bluegill just gets sucked right in or whatever he's trying to eat.
If you've never seen one and you ever get a chance to see one that's over 20 pounds, you know, their heads are, what Ben's talking about, their heads are just so large and it's just a vacuum. It's a whirlpool is what it is. They can create that suction and there's nothing a prey fish will be able to do to get out of the way of that thing.
No, and they can eat, as Tyler will tell you, they can eat just about anything that they can fit at least a third of in their mouth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've had them in our live wells, and they'll spit out a 6-7 pound largemouth that they had down their gullet. So, I mean, it's definitely a fish that can eat larger fish for sure.
So, you know, one of the problems that we have is they are apex predator. They are competing with other species that may or may not be doing as well. And so they do have some conservation concerns. So there's this balancing act that we as managers have to do between talking to anglers like Tyler and saying,
go catch them.
Have at them. We'd love for you to take them. And then, you know, the other side of the equation, trying to restore herring, striped bass, native catfish.
Yeah. Carolina Mad Tom, which is an endangered catfish that are basically being wiped out from flatheads. So it's things that we have to talk about for sure.
It is a challenge and it's like anything, there's good and bad to everything. And we can't say that they're great. We can't say that they're terrible because there's both sides to that equation. Yeah.
They're here, right? What we don't want is we don't want people moving them to new places if we can help that. Currently, as far as we know, flatheads are not in the Roanoke proper down below Roanoke Rapids Dam, but they are in the lakes up above it. So one would think it's just a matter of time before they're there. But basically, they're about everywhere else. We have a few native catfish rivers left, but they are really small drainages right along the coast. Ben, you can tell us which ones those are because they're not
just
in my mind.
Just a handful. And when we say native, even it's important to know that even channel catfish are not native. Everybody kind of, because they've been around for so long.
And we'll clarify, native to the Atlantic Slope River Basin. So if you go across the Continental Divide in our state, to the west, all three of those species are native to those areas because that's Mississippi River basins.
Right. There is a section in the mountains where these fish are found native and naturally. But on the coast and really from the mountains our way, they're not native. The ones that are native are your white catfish, your bullheads, your little mad toms, which not many people really see.
No, they never see them.
And the few rivers that it don't have them are normally your smaller coastal creeks, which is why a few years ago we made them an inland game fish to kind of try to give them a little more protection. And we gave them a krill limit too.
Yeah.
So there's only a handful, and most of those have some sort of, they're salty at the mouth.
Was that like the white oak, the new?
The white oak, the new, maybe Lockwood Folly.
Yeah.
Pungo has a lot of white catfish. and bullheads, but I don't know that it's an exclusive.
Yeah, probably not.
Pungo may be an equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot, and a lot of people don't realize this, especially blue cats in particular, they don't bat an eye at a little bit of salt or even a lot of salt.
No, no, no. Blue cats definitely. Flatheads, not so much, but blue cats definitely will get salty.
So it's very likely that, you know, especially in a wet year, that
they can get to the Pungo for sure.
That they would be coming through the ICW, through the Alligator River, and across the Sound maybe even. But for the most part, the Pungo still has a decent population of native catfish. And what you may think is, well, they don't get as big, so they're not as cool. But, I mean, they're what was here, you know, from the get-go. And so in that right, they're cool. And because you can still go there and those fish are still fun to catch.
Yeah.
And prolific in those systems. And so it's kind of neat to, as a fish biologist and a fisherman, really, it's neat to go to somewhere and see what that fish assemblage looked like before all this other stuff happened.
Well, I think I probably said it on the podcast with Tyler before. In my childhood along the Neuse, I can remember the dominant catfish species being white cats. I mean, I can remember that. Even though the Neuse has had flatheads for a long period of time and blue cats a little later, the white cat was the most dominant thing that we caught in the river when I was a little kid. But that has changed drastically over the last 20 to 25 years. Now, white cats are basically non-existent. They have been eradicated from the Neuse proper. Maybe not completely. There's probably a few that show up every once in a while, but the bullheads and the white cats, and a white cat is a type of a bullhead. It's just a larger one. They just don't exist anymore to the point where you're not really going to catch them. You're really going to catch flatheads and blues now. And that's what we're talking about, is that when you move a fish, which we talk about this on the podcast a lot, we've talked about it with Alabama bass and river herring and all kinds of things.
Bait
of different varieties and stuff. Just please don't move fish. We don't know what the consequences. There will be a consequence. I can about bet on it. There will be a consequence. We don't know the consequences of what the next fish that somebody decides they want to move around. And there are still places where we're trying to hold out, which we just talked about. We're trying to hold out for white cats and bullheads, realizing that we know that flatheads and blues are going to rule the day in all our main rivers. But these little small pockets where we have native fish, please don't move these flatheads and blues to those areas.
So don't move fish. We've talked about that.
Yeah. Fish need water.
Fish need water. So we'll get Tyler in on this.
Announcement.
Tyler, and this is much to the chagrin of another large angling group out there. Tyler, as I've seen him use a bass for bait. And he's smiling because he's like licking his chops at the opportunity. But this is where this conversation gets used. Tyler, and to the rest of the catfish community, there's another bass on the scene called the Alabama bass. Don't take them out of where they're supposed to be and put them somewhere where they're not.
Yeah, just don't use them for bait.
Yeah.
I mean, really and truly, that's the key. Because a lot of people would go catch bait, take it with them, and then dump it in the river, which is illegal. But a lot of people do that. And when they do that, they're moving that fish. And right now, our coastal rivers, other than the very upper end of the Roanoke and the very upper end of the Tar, right now, our coastal rivers are Alabama bass free. But if our folks start using them for catfish bait, go to reservoirs and catch a bunch of them, bring them down and start using them, we're going to have Alabama bass everywhere. So know what you're using. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I use my word. Absolutely. You could have said for real.
So we were on the boat. I'm going to tell a funny story for a minute since we're in this fish barge. We're on this boat. I'm holding this nice blue catfish.
On camera.
The first question out of Chris's mouth is,
bang.
Ben, why does that catfish make the noise that it's making? And I mean, Corey and I know a lot of things about fish. We don't know a lot of things about a lot of things, but we know a lot of things about fish.
Easy.
And I kind of fumbled it.
You made an absolute story.
When they make the croaking noise, that is from the air bladder, and I kind of went that direction, but really it wasn't right. And
horrible, then later,
I was like, let's just not put that on the show. So if it makes it on the show, just pay me no mind.
He's lying. He wasn't lying. He just was wrong.
But, and many of you guys who have caught, especially a blue catfish, they make kind of this clicking noise with their spines when they hit the floor of the boat. And it happens fairly regularly. And I'd never really thought much about it. But when on camera, I was asked about it.
And Chris asks some weird questions when you're on camera. He'll catch you off guard in a heartbeat.
He did.
He's done it numerous times to me, so don't feel bad.
We had talked about many other catfish things.
that we knew about.
That we'd already talked about, and yet he comes from left field with something I wasn't quite prepared for. But because I like to make all new mistakes, I went home and went on a deep dive and figured out what that clicking noise is and why.
There's a comedian that says, "What's that clicking noise?" Anyway, continue. Yeah.
There's a chance that I could probably talk for the next 30 minutes about that clicking noise because I did go on a deep, deep dive. But the real end of it is it's called pectoral stridulation, and it's a distress code. And apparently the specific tone of it, we hear it, you know, it's kind of a clicking noise, but birds hear it even more so. And so, you know, the thought is that, I mean, and Corey's already pointed out that ospreys don't pay it a bit of mind, but maybe there's some other birds that where they're native, which ospreys are there too.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some other birds that when they grab it and they hear that clicking noise, it kind of startles them and makes them drop the fish back in the water. So it's a defense or distress.
We'll let it ride.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of ospreys eat a lot of blue cats.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't think ospreys pay much attention to it.
But there's other birds that eat blue cats, and that was the theory in the literature.
But you'll see it. If you watch a TV show, you'll see them do it. You'll actually hear them do it, probably, mm-hmm. if the camera picked it up. You'll see it's like this vibration that their pectoral spines do. So thank you, Ben, for finding out why they did it. We appreciate the deep dive that you spent and the time that you spent down that hole. Find it.
I just try not to. And once I've found an area of ignorance, I try not to live in it.
What was hilarious was you were being videoed. You know, Chris was asking questions and he asked you that question. And I could tell, like, it just threw you for a look. Like, you were like, oh no, I don't know what this is. And then you started talking about the gas bladder. I was like, he's wrong about that.
Yeah, I've been wrong.
I don't
before.
Know why they do it, but that's not what they're doing.
And I'm totally comfortable with saying, I don't know.
You owned it.
Let's try this. And then you're like, no.
Chris was like,
I'm waffling
okay, and
here.
And when the camera quit, I was like, no, we got to cut that. That ain't right.
So, not everybody knows everything all the time.
It's important. Every day for me.
It's important to figure out to know people where you can get the information from, though. So
yeah.
That's what I wound up doing. So what else do we need to talk about, Corey?
Well, I will say that we had a great day. We ended up catching, it was probably over 20 fish, maybe 20, 25 fish, and most of them were in the high teens up to 30 pounds. I mean, there was a couple of small guys, you know, 8, 9 pounders, which one of the guys was out with us was like, that's the biggest one I've ever caught. So you never know what's going to be somebody's personal best, for sure. Particularly when they don't fish for something very often.
One of the things, and I mean, the Rona, basically they're all across
everywhere.
Whole state, really.
Yeah.
But all of these coastal rivers have, especially the major coastal rivers, have either blues or flatheads. And yeah. It's a very great angling opportunity for you to catch a pretty big fish. And you, I mean, not that it doesn't take skill, but once you figure out what you need to do, you can do it. You know, you don't need a whole lot of crazy gear to do it. You know, it's not like going way offshore or something like that.
I mean, there's a couple of take homes for me is one, you can do it like Tyler does it. And that's the professional way to do it, in my opinion. I mean, your success rate's going to be pretty high in the sense of you're not going to lose many fish. You're geared up so high that once you hook them up, you got them. You tend to catch bigger fish because you're using bigger baits, but you can also catch 8 to 10 pound blue cats fairly regularly with less gear involved and not as much gear involved. And once again, it's about learning where they are, what they're doing, what they're feeding on, that kind of thing. It's the same principle that all our shows talk about. And so it's a very doable thing. You don't have to go buy 10 rods unless you just want to. And they don't all have to be yellow, but I will tell you,
it helps,
and you will be talked about by other catfish anglers if you're not that way, I'm pretty sure, because they're very stylish. But yeah, I mean, we had a great day. We caught lots of fish, in my opinion, for what we were doing, and big fish, and you know, we never caught that 50-pounder, but you were like, yeah, that'd be a unicorn today on these conditions. So you kind of knew, I mean, you've done it enough, Tyler, that you kind of knew what we were getting into, and I think the flatheads kind of threw you for a little bit of a loop, you know, that we tended to catch a bunch of those.
It did. I think we actually, what did we do, catch five, maybe five or four or five at least, and they were good.
Yeah, it was at least five. Nice, very nice. I mean, they were over 20, and some were maybe a little over 30.
Yeah. You know? By the end of the day, it was about 50-50.
Yeah, it was actually very unusual. Unusual as the flatheads, you know, get dormant in the winter and start picking up again in the spring. It was, I thought we could catch some, but I didn't think it'd be that great, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't a super cold day. It was cold to start. It was probably in the 30s when we started out the day. And of course, we had to ride 450 miles up the river to find the spot because there's evidently none near the boat ramp, which, you know, whatever. Thank God for that windshield on that boat. Kept me warm. I'm a desk biologist now. I don't like to get cold anymore. But it was a good day.
It's easy to stay warm if you're pulling that anchor rope on the regular.
Yeah, you were sweating. You were sweating. I was not. I was a little cold most of the time. I wonder why that was.
So, I mean, but really, if you're trying to figure out or learn it for the first time, I mean, we really, all we did was hop from eddy to eddy to eddy. Now, some of those were formed by ledges or creek mouths or an indentation in the side of the bank or a rock ledge. But basically, all we did was fish eddies the whole day. Right, Tyler?
Yeah, pretty much.
And one thing I did learn from you on that trip is it depends on the flow as to where the eddy's going to be. Like, the eddy's not always in the same place depending on the water level of the river, which these coastal rivers, they go up and down quite a bit, particularly in the late winter, early spring with all the rain that we've been getting here lately.
Yeah, it's been real flashy here lately, which is another thing. If you're going to do this, be aware of your conditions.
Yeah, I mean, it probably dropped 4, maybe 5 inches while we were out there. The water level did. I mean, because we went over the shoals and everybody was like, yay, that's great. And then coming back down, Tyler's like, I don't know. It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough.
It'll go up. I mean, it can go up several feet in hours and it can fall several feet too. So it's definitely got to be, like you said, prepared and know your body of water. And if you're not new to that body of water, I'd recommend going at least under stable conditions until you get the hang of things for sure, because it can be dangerous.
The last thing we haven't covered that I think we probably do need to cover is that we as biologists and fish managers get a lot of requests, maybe not a lot, but we get requests from anglers to regulate fish that they really, really love. And catfish anglers are no different.
They love their catfish.
They love their catfish.
Tyler does.
Tyler loves their catfish. They love their trophy fish, the big, large ones. Completely understand it. But a lot of times they'll be like, well, we need to regulate that. We need to protect those larger fish. Ben, can you explain to us where we are in terms of regulating those fish, why we haven't done that?
And Tyler and I have talked off of a podcast just ad nauseum about this.
Yeah.
And I think he may finally be on the right page. He's nodding at least. He's not going to say it where we're recording. He's at least giving me a nod.
He ain't going down that road, brother.
But there's other people listening. They're like, I can't believe you support his
gobbledygook.
So, one, we have tremendous catfish populations in the state. You know, and Tyler, feel free to pitch in anytime. We have tremendous catfish populations in the state. Yes, they're not native, but yes, they're doing really, really well. And so they're really, especially with blue catfish, but really flatheads are in the same boat. They're doing so well that there's no real need to protect them. And a lot of people like trophy regulations. This is about regulations in general right now. A regulation has to force you to release a fish that you would otherwise keep in order for it to have any impact. And Tyler, I mean, you are as well versed as anybody in the state with catfishing. How many big catfish are getting kept across the state?
Man, I tell you, as the sport grows, the angler is practicing catch and release, really on any size. I mean, a lot of times when people do keep these catfish, they're 10 pounds and under. But for majority of the time, I don't see a whole lot of Mondo catfish being taken out. They're always take a picture, release it, and catch it again someday. So I think it's, as far as the catfish, man, and from what I've seen, fishing the Cape Fear and the Noose and the Tar, these fish are getting bigger and better than they've ever been.
Right. So we've got several things going on. One, they're not native, so we don't really, from a conservation standpoint, we don't really want to protect them so much. But two, they're doing so well that we don't need to protect them. And three, the vast majority of the angling bases is releasing them anyway. So a trophy reg would really only be useful if trophy fish were being over harvested. It really wouldn't even create more trophy fish, because you don't produce more trophy fish. You'd have to protect them at a much younger size if that's what you were trying to do.
Yeah.
So really, there's no real reason, if things were, if we truly wanted to manage them to make them better, we're already doing that. It's kind of the take-home message. They actually can support a lot of harvest.
Yeah.
And we're nowhere near the harvest levels that would even kind of make us question that.
I mean, literally right now, both species in almost every place, particularly in the coast, their foot's on the gas in terms of growth, their overall size of the population, their foot is on the gas. At some point, we will likely make it to equilibriums where things kind of level off or get where they're going to be. I don't know when that's coming. I have no idea.
Just in my time in Central North Carolina, when I first started, there was 40-pounders everywhere, but we rarely saw 50s. Now, 50s in our surveys are not necessarily the strangest thing. Like, we still think it's a very impressive fish because it is.
Yeah.
But it's not a unicorn by any means. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see them. And, you know, the tar's the same way. The tar had a lot of fish. Now it's starting to have lots of 40-pound fish. And, you know, in another few years, it'll be producing 50s the same way. The Roanoke is a blue catfish factory.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Whether we like it or not, it is. And to the point that it's making us question some of our other management strategies as far as, well, how much blue cats are doing so well and other fish populations aren't. Are those blue catfish causing a problem?
Yep.
You know, either through direct or indirect competition, one way or the other. So,
and there may come a time way down the road where we're going to look to you guys, Tyler, and be like, if you want big fish, you might need to start taking some fish home in order to produce them. I mean, we're nowhere near that. But that's the thing about people wanting big fish and more of them. It doesn't necessarily always exist. It's existing in the catfish world right now. But, you know, there'll come a time where there'll be so many of them that they'll be outcompeting themselves, basically, and start stunning themselves. Now, we're, like I said, I don't have a crystal ball. We're a long ways from that. But there may come a time where we'll be like, hey, you know those 10-pounders? If you want the 80-pounders, take those 10-pounders home.
And we have seen that in some regards because of the hurricanes and hurricane fish kills. We've seen some resets over the last probably 15 years where there was a fish kill due to a hurricane. It knocked the fish way back, and then they start building themselves right back up. And then at some point, they've built themselves up to some sort of threshold, and they start to not grow as fast as they were.
That's right. It's just fish biology. Seems simple, but sometimes it's not.
Most times it seems to be not as simple as it should
be. It should be, yeah. That's right.
Well, Tyler, do you have any questions for us about catfish? He's already got it all figured out. I don't even know why I'm asking this question.
Where they hide me? Where they hide me?
So this is...
Listen to you.
For, I would say, almost a year, Tyler would call me up or text me and say, hey, have you ever been here? Yes. Are there catfish there? Yes. And my answer to Tyler was always like, Tyler,
they are
everywhere.
I was like, me and you pull them away.
There's not a place where they're not. And Tyler went to all those places, and it what happened?
Caught fish everywhere.
They are everywhere. In fact, one night he called me, and he told me where he was. I was like, given the flows, I ain't even sure how you got there.
He walked.
Full seeing, man. Never let up. He said, you're where at?
I know how he got there. I just was in a boat with him. Exactly. It's a throttle down and pray to God that we make it.
Yeah. I told him where a deep hole was, and he was headed there regardless of...
What, rocks?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but no, it's been great. It's been great the last few years getting to know Tyler and talking catfish with him. I have learned a lot about catfish from him. I've learned a lot about fishing from him, and some of those I've been able to steal and use for myself. And that's been very helpful in my world.
And, you know, I've only been around him a few times, and I will say this about him. He is just genuinely a good dude. he wants to take time. He wants to teach. He wants people to tune in to his TikToks and learn about fishing. And so that I have an appreciation for, because, you know, when you're trying to get new people into the sport, it takes people like you to do that. So I appreciate that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people that are fishing at the level that Tyler is, getting information out of them is kind of like,
never happens. Yeah.
It's like asking them for, you know, the Holy Grail.
Their first child.
Yeah. So, but he's very forthright with it, and he's happy to share information.
He wants the sport to grow, and you can see that in his TikToks. And I mean, he's out there on the beach fishing, not even catfishing, and he's got like 300,000 people watching him. I'm like, I don't know if I want that, but I mean, I'm glad he does. So
that's it.
Well, is it time to talk about some questions?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So as always, send in your questions. We keep getting them. We appreciate them. As we mentioned in the previous podcast, for the year, we got a swag bag. We got a bunch of stuff that's got our logo on it. We got some other things that's got our wildlife diamond on it as well, that we're giving away, and we pick one every month from people that send questions. So we'll go to questions, and then Ben will tell us who our winner is for the month of March.
Yeah, and don't forget, when you send your question in, if you give us an address, I'll send you a logo. It's
very helpful.
A decal.
Yeah, a decal. And might as well put your shirt size in there, too, just in case you just get drunk, so we don't have to ask again.
That's right. It might help your chances of getting drunk.
It might help your chances of getting drunk.
Especially if I'm busy.
Yeah, that's right. Look, he's sending his shirt size. He'll be the winner. You can tell how this outfit's run.
So, Mr. Gomez, he sent me an email and he's asking questions. He's been fishing Lake Norman.
Uh-oh.
A lake that is near and dear to Corey.
Uh-oh.
And High Rock, which is another lake that's near and dear to Corey.
Yeah.
What are the impacts of extremely reduced water clarity, 6 inches or less? What does it do to the bass fishing in those lakes? And what do you do from there?
Well, they're two totally different lakes, for sure. Norman is what we call an oligotrophic lake, which means the water generally is clear. It hasn't been clear this winter and spring due to massive flows that we've had in the system. But the watershed at Norman's really small. Even though it's on the Catawba River, it just doesn't have a lot of inputs from other places. And so it generally remains pretty clear, which means it's low productivity. And when it does muddy and get unclear, fishing can be very tough there. I will say that. The fish are used to being sight predators and feeding that way. So doesn't mean you can't catch fish. It just means it's going to be more difficult. You know, we can talk about baits and all that, but generally at Norman, you're fishing a bait that looks very natural. Like it looks just like an alewife or just like a threadfin shad. It's going to be silvery, white, clear. You're going to use fluorocarbon for your leaders because the fish can see your line so well. I mean, there's places in Norman during certain times of the year, you may be able to see 15, 20 feet down. Now, High Rock's totally different. High Rock is a very turbid system, stays turbid most of the year. It's very productive, has a lot of nutrient flow. The fish there are not as much sight predator type fish. They're used to feeding in muddy water. So those fish don't necessarily clam up when it gets muddy. I will say at Norman, they'll clam up right to start with, but if it stays muddy, fish will start feeding in that muddy water. Eventually, they'll switch over to feeding by not being so much of a sight predator. But two totally different lakes. Norman's deep, High Rock shallow. I mean, it's just two totally different systems. So you're going to have to adapt to that pattern that you need, whether it's using natural looking colors in clear water or using, you know, brighter colors in turbid water or something that makes a noise or a sound in turbid water. You know, those kinds of things are going to have to happen for sure.
Right. Yeah. I think as a general rule, the clearer the water, the more natural presentation, the more maybe even no sound or natural sounds that bait needs to make. The darker the water, you need a louder bait, a more brightly colored bait. Also, something with contrasting colors.
Yep.
So something that's, you know, half one color, half another color. A lot of times in real murky water, they can pick up on that.
Yep.
But in cleaner water, it's so bold that it kind of basically scares them off. You know?
Yeah. I mean, Norman is pretty much clear year-round unless we get really high flows. And even the very southern end of the lake sometimes doesn't even get muddy down there. Even in real high flows, it'll stay clear down there as well. It's just a part of the lake, and it's the way that lake is made. And when I have fished it, it has always been generally the baits are smaller. They're generally natural in color, and you use fairly long leaders with fluorocarbon to hide the line. A lot of that kind of stuff has to happen at Norman to be successful, for sure.
So, Tyler, in the summertime on the noose, we get a hard rain and it muddies up. What does that do to the catfish?
I think it makes them more active. One of the key things on a hard rise is it does a couple things. It pushes the bait fish out of the little sloughs, the little creeks, out of the log jams, and they've got to go somewhere. They can't hold up there any longer. And that also gets the catfish up and active. And that's another key thing for a reason why I focus on hitting or anchoring my boat close to the banks. It could be on the inside of a bend. That's why, like, a lot of times, like, insides of bends or on hard ledges is pretty productive, because on the inside or the back inside of a bend or the backside of a bend, currents generally a little slower there. There can be some bait fish staged up, or maybe even on a large drop where the river may go from 5 feet to 15, 20 feet straight down. Well, although the current's flowing fast on top, and it looks like it's fast, it's relatively calmer on the bottom of that ledge, which is essentially what we targeted on the Cape Fear in that situation. Yeah. You know, it was fast flows, and the fish were hunkered down at the bottom of the ledges.
So if you're beating your head against the wall because your bass fishing's gone to pot because it's... Because it's got muddy on you.
Yeah.
Sounds like you need to head up the river
and maybe try
a catfish. That might be the...
Adapt and overcome.
The exact right time to try that.
That's the way I fish anyway. Whatever wants to bite my line, I'm all for it.
All right. So that was a good question. Here we go. Here's another one. This one's... Tyler's probably got some experience here because it's about the Neuse River between Goldsboro and Smithfield.
Mm. Can be touchy.
He says he has a question most likely for Ben. Corey's about to say something about why I picked this question.
First off, I was on the Neuse River between Smithfield and Goldsboro long before Ben ever was.
That's the truth. But, so,
whatever.
He grew up on the Neuse between Goldsboro and Smithfield, mainly, and this question's in regard to stripers and shad.
Oh.
And he knows that that area has been electrofished a lot, which is also
that's
true.
An accurate
and
representation.
Some of that I have done.
Yes.
Is it believed that this is the area that fish spawn? And that's his main question. And he says he's never really seen a rock fight or something like that on the Neuse. Tyler, have you ever seen a rock fight in all your time on the Neuse?
Every time I've ever seen it has been in Smithfield.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah. So, yes, the shad definitely are spawning in Goldsboro and then up. Basically near Raleigh, right below the dam. Those are kind of the two areas. They don't really seem to use Smithfield. In our surveys, it seems like we don't ever really find an aggregate of shad in Smithfield. It seems like when we get them, they're just passing through. Stripers, on the other hand, depending on flow, can spawn anywhere between Kinston and Raleigh.
That's right.
And I've seen spawning fights in Goldsboro. I've seen spawning fights in Kinston, and I've even seen spawning fights in Raleigh. So it really just depends on the flow. Now, most people by now know that the striped bass are basically a hatchery-supported stock there. They are spawning. They are going through the motions, but there's something going on in the river that is limiting those fertilized eggs to becoming equating to, you know, little stripers swimming around, and we're spending a lot of time and resources right now
trying to figure that out. Yeah.
But they are, you know, a lot of people have said, well, those are stockfish, they don't spawn. That's not true. They do spawn. They are going through the motions, but there's something that's limiting them, most likely in that larval or juvenile stage, that's just limiting them. I mean, we would like to see the population stronger so that it can start to be self-sustainable and replace itself, but there's something that we should be seeing it at a low level that we're really not right now.
That's right. That's a good answer.
Okay, good answer.
I wouldn't have said anything different. You do have experience on that part of the river. Surprise, surprise.
I have a little bit of experience on the Neuse. I've been around a time or two. It's actually one of my favorite stretches of river in the state, to be honest. It's one of the most forgotten places in the state.
It is.
I mean, Tyler, when you're there, you don't see a whole lot of people, do you?
You don't see a soul.
If it ain't a catfish boat or shad season, it can be a ghost town.
Yeah, outside of shad season.
I've been down that stretch a bunch doing work, and I might have seen two boats in my entire life. Now, some of that wasn't during shad season, so.
Right. So, We got one more question. It's about largemouth bass. Trying to find, nobody sent any catfish. They didn't question.
Sorry, Tyler. Sorry. Maybe you're not as popular as I said earlier.
Well, we didn't advertise that we were.
I'm kidding. I know.
So they'll probably roll in after the fact. We'll have to pull Tyler in to get questions. F1 Bass in Lake Gaston. How he's seeing my angler here, Mr. Smith, is seeing bass. They're small. You know, we just stocked last year, was the first year, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So he's seeing small bass. They're very aggressive. And he's wanting to know if he can assume that those are F1s or what's going on, because of just they're trying to eat his lure and they're the same size as the fish. What's going on there?
So could they be F1s? Sure.
I mean, we did stock some.
We did. I don't know that they're necessarily that much more aggressive than a standard largemouth would be that are already occurring in the lake. It would be very difficult to tell. One, they're going to be really small right now. I mean, they're probably not more than 6 inches long at this point. They might be a little bit longer, but probably not.
He said they were the same size as his worm, so that's probably getting, that's about staging right. up.
Yeah, about 6 inches. So I'm not saying that they're not F1s. That's not my point. But the only real way to tell that would be to take a fin clip off of that fish, take it to a geneticist, and get it tested, which we're doing. That's part of the experimental project that we're doing on Gaston, Jordan, and Norman with the F1 stockings, is to figure out, do these fish grow faster? Do they get bigger over a period of time than a standard largemouth would be? And do they just persist in the population? Because we don't know if they will or will not survive. Historically, bass stockings are not the greatest thing in the world in terms of survival, but we'll see with F1s. Virginia's doing some work. Tennessee's doing some work. So we're kind of working together in the Southeast to figure out if F1s are a good tool for bass management in the future.
I would just add to that one, young bass in general are very aggressive.
Very aggressive. If you're growing them in a hatchery, you have to separate them pretty quick as they difference in size, because they'll start eating each other.
They will eat themselves.
I mean, they'll eat themselves in a heartbeat.
But the other thing is, like Corey said, it's hard to know. There's a lot of reproduction that happens in Gaston. The guys that fish it are fishing spawning beds for a reason. It's because they're in there spawning.
That's right.
And so it's hard to know. And this was the first year of spawning or stocking, so it's even more likely that just due to abundance, statistically, you likely did not see an F1 yet.
Yeah. It's going to take time. I mean, that's the one thing I would tell our anglers is you just got to be patient. We're going to stay on top of it. We're going to keep stocking. We're going to figure out if it's working or if it's not working. And we're going to report back to anglers what we find. That's what we do anyway. That's what we do with every species we work on. So just contact us and we'll be glad to share all the information we have about it.
Yeah. Everything we do
is for y'all.
And we're also trying to evaluate it to figure out.
Yeah.
You know, because if something...
This is not a cheap game, I will say that.
No.
Stocking F1s is not cheap, and we don't want to do it if it's not successful, but we also want to give it its due diligence and make sure that we're doing it the right way and figuring out what works and what doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, we also, if something works, we want to be able to point a finger at it and say, this is what caused it.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of times, especially you look back at fisheries management, something got better, and it maybe didn't get better for the reasons that you thought you would
did
in hindsight. So it's become really important for us to really be able to trace our efforts over time to really document
things. And we have
new
tools. We have geneticists. We have different techniques that we didn't have 10 years ago that have changed the landscape of fish management. And so it's a little bit different world, and we're able to track things a lot better than we once were able to.
It's an incredibly powerful tool to be able to take a fin clip off a fish and know whether or not it was stocked, but also know what year it was stocked.
Yeah.
Like that's insane. Yeah, we know how being able to trace stuff.
We know how old it is. We know everything about it. Know it's mama, know it's daddy. You know, it's crazy what we can do with genetics now.
It's helped us out a lot to really kind of peek behind the curtain and really know what's going on.
I know we need to finish, but we know things. We thought we knew things about American shad and striped bass on the coast. We thought we knew things. And then genetics came along and we were like, oh, we really didn't know.
Yeah, quite. We were about 180 off of what we thought.
We were 180 degrees where we should have been. We thought that with striped bass, I'll use that example on the coast, we thought forever and a day that the stocking efforts on the tar noose and the Cape Fear were maybe what, 5-10% of
minimal.
It was a minimal contribution to the overall population. And then genetics came along and we found out, oh no, it's 90-100% of the contribution. There's actually
maximal.
Yeah, there's like no natural reproduction going on the river. And it's like, uh-oh, we're in a lot bigger trouble than we thought on the river. And so that's why you've seen all these things happen along the river, these moratoriums on striped bass and that kind of stuff. It's not because we don't want anglers to catch them. We're trying to figure out how to help the population because the population's in such dire straits. Yeah, I know it seems harsh and it seems punitive at times, and we don't really want it. We want to catch them too.
Absolutely.
I mean, my daddy rings my chimes all the time about it. He lives on the news and he wants to catch a striped bass. I get it, man. That's what I grew up doing. So I 100% understand. But that genetics tool has taught us so much about our management that we did not know.
So Mr. Smith's question was a great one, and it led to some good discussion. He was actually the winner.
Ding, ding.
So you guys, please remember, send us your questions. You never know. You might be the selected one. Also, some months fairly lean on questions. So, you know, your chances of winning
might be the higher. Yeah.
So,
yeah, sometimes we get a lot of questions. Sometimes we don't get as much.
We also sometimes do two podcasts at once. So, you know,
yeah,
your questions,
yeah,
by default, you may win. Who
knows?
That's
right. Back to back.
It's been great. Really enjoyed having Tyler on again. Probably do it again some other time too, since he's a frequent flyer on the podcast now.
Yeah.
Try to hook him in early before he gets too big.
All right, he's getting big. His head's getting huge. I mean, it's problematic, but that's okay. We can't thank you enough. Appreciate you being on the podcast. You're great as always. You were a magnificent host for Carolina All Out and for us on the boat, and we can't thank you enough for that as well.
Well, I appreciate y'all having me on. It's been definitely a blast, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yep, sounds good. Thank y'all for listening.
Appreciate you. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission's podcast, Better Fishing with Two Bald Biologists. For more information, please visit ncwildlife.org or email us at twobaldbiologists@ncwildlife.org.